Pseudopod episode 174, December 25th. Happy Christmas, everyone! 2009. This week's story, The Primakov, by RJ Hobbs. Happy festive time of year, everyone. I'm Alistair, your host for this most Christmassy of traditions, a weekly trek into the darkest side of human nature. And while Pseudopod is always open, even at Christmas, this week's story is a real treat for me as we revisit one of my favourite subgenres, nautical horror. Your author this week is Roger Hobbs, a student of literature at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. His work has appeared in the New York Times and several anthologies. His plays have run in theatres up and down the Atlantic, and his movie review blog can be found at midnightmovieguide.blogspot.com. He even provides us with a fun fact, friends, that the coldest natural temperature ever recorded on Earth was minus 89.2 degrees Celsius. Your narrator this week is known in all the boroughs, so prepare for a voyage over the horizon, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Primakov, by R.J. Hobbs. This is what we know about the last voyage of the Rusoil Primakov. Sometime between 2200 and 0400, on January 3rd, the Rusoil Primakov supertanker disappeared off the coast of Siberia. Since then, the waters along its route have been scanned thoroughly for remains, but not a single scrap of metal or drop of oil has been found, suggesting the fate of the giant ship. End to end, the Primakov was longer than the Empire State Building, making it the largest missing object in the world. It carried five crew members: Captain Richard Elmore of the United States, a Kings Point graduate who had run more than 100 trans-Pacific crossings over 20 years. His salt and pepper hair was rough and weathered from the freezing Arctic winds. Below him were three Korean engineers, Alan Chu, Michael Park, and Pak C. Ray, who had been part of the original design team during the creation of the Primakov at the Tremen Sung shipyards in Seoul. Their faces were the emotionless glares of men who only saw the sun for 4 hours a day. Finally, there was the ship's only passenger, Jerome Roberts, an American video journalist based out of the Seattle Times-Gazette. He was the first black resident of Kamchatka when he was stationed there 6 months before to research the industry of eastern Siberia. Borscht never sat well with him. The ship flew the colors of the Russian Federation. In the tanks were more than 6,000 gallons of refined gasoline. When it disappeared off the face of the earth, the $1 million in petrol it carried went with it. It was a Tuesday night when the Primakov received an emergency transmission on the ICT radio from the Bakopor, a distressed fishing vessel from Petropavlovsk. The captain translated the Russian slowly, word by word, with a phrasebook. The night was completely calm, and the ocean lapped up against the hull with gentle, rhythmic intensity. The Bakopor had lost fuel after a storm and required additional petrol if the sailors were ever to see their wives and mothers again. The Primakov wouldn't even have to change direction to give them assistance. Captain Richard Elmore paused and considered what it would cost in time, money, and fuel to aid the small fishing vessel before he emailed his commander in Moscow to confirm the deviation from the itinerary. The email remained unopened until the 5th month of the investigation. That Saturday, a freak freezing air pattern near the Urals had caused violent seas near Petropavlovsk that had sunk several fishing vessels. The Bakopor weathered the storm, but lost two sailors. They had stayed afloat for less than 5 seconds in the choppy waters as their final screams froze in their lungs. Elmore made the call. The tanker had more than enough diesel to make their trip twice over without dipping into their customers' tanks. He pressed the button on the radio and sent the message himself in crisp, clear English. Jerome translated it through the ICT as Elmore scanned the cloudless skies with his binoculars. They were coming to assist with fuel and replacement parts for their engine, but the temperature was dropping and the Primakov still 5 hours away. Roberts recorded an interview with Elmore that evening. His face was a grimace in the cold. Even in the command center, frost formed on the glass. What are we doing right now?
Right now, we're going to answer a distress call from a local fishing ship, but it's cold out there tonight. The temperature is dropping pretty fast, and you don't want to be there without heater engines. What if you can't fix them up? Elmore swallowed loudly. We'll have to wait for the VMF to send a rescue ship all the way from Petropavlovsk. But knowing how far we are from Russia, if we can't help them, they're dead in the water without heat. The engineers played backgammon next to the coffee machine. Steam rose up from each fresh cup. Roberts videotaped them, wrapped up in their heavy coats, as they rolled the dice. They didn't give interviews. The hours dropped off the clock. Roberts wrote in his blog, "Sailors stranded in North Atlantic without engines. Sunset at 3:48 p.m. I wouldn't want to be out there. Crew is praying for the sailors." When it finally appeared, the fishing boat was dark on the horizon. Elmore watched the dark ship grow closer through the lens of his binoculars. The Korean engineers wore blankets over their heads as they sat at their positions behind the helm. Their breath formed icicles in the air. "Looks like we won't need the AFFF. They're as dark as the devil out there." They weren't kidding about losing power, not even a light bulb. The captain looked down from his binoculars. "Call them." The midshipman hailed the backup port on all frequencies. There was no response. The ship was like a black silhouette against the reflection of the moon. It bobbed peacefully on the waters, as if it had been moored and abandoned. "Do you think they ran out of juice for their radio?" "I wouldn't bet on it. They should have redundant backups for their ICT. Should we send a crew over to check it out?" The Primakov used one of its cranes to lower Captain Elmore and Jerome Roberts onto the tiny vessel. Roberts wore a video camera strapped inside his jacket. The two men wore flotation vests and heavy coats for the cold, but they knew the vests were symbolic because they wouldn't have time to drown. The giant crane lifted the two men by nylon and carabiners with a slow lurching tug. The small ship creaked gently as their boots connected with the wooden bow. "Crack a light? I'm on it." Elmore snapped one of the glow rods on his vest and held it out like a torch as he stepped down onto the deck. The eerie green glow cast shadows over the small vessel's mangled nets. End to end, the ship was barely 45 meters. "Looks like they ditched most of their catch during the storm. This machinery looks pretty wrecked, too." Jerome carried the camera in his left hand. His breathing was rough and fast, even for a man who had lived in the wilds of Siberia in a city with no roads. His right hand clutched a bracing knife as he followed the captain past the piles of twisted metal and splintered wood toward the pitch-black plexiglass of the command bridge. "That wasn't the storm." Captain Elmore looked back toward the camera with green eyes. "These salmon drops are industrial steel. The storm would have sent this ship to Davy before tearing those off." "Then what happened?" "Whoever sent that distress call knows." The captain announced his arrival with a deafening shout in the hopes that some voice might respond through the wreckage. His voice echoed out over the calm waters like a whisper in the darkness. The green light covered his face in shadows. Elmore climbed over the collapsed fishing equipment. For a moment, his light disappeared behind the piles of rotted fish and tattered nets. Robert's breath was quickened in the darkness. When the captain appeared at the top, even the faint illumination of his glow rod was a relief as Robert's hands gripped the tattered nets that covered the wreckage. The black shadow of the Primakov hung over them like a dark mountain. "It's a bit of a drop-off on this side," Elmore said. His light reflected against the pale waters directly below them. The deck on that side of the ship had been torn away as if by some enormous bite. Roberts felt sick all of a sudden, and held his hand over the lens of his camera as he retched into the frozen waters. The captain radioed back to the Primakov. "We'll have to climb the rest of the way to the cabin," the captain said. "If these Bastayas are still alive, they'll need more than a few lug bolts and a can of petrol. Get the VMF on their way." Static came in with a low buzz. When Roberts recovered from his sickness, he stood and his paring knife slipped from his fingers. He reached for it, but in a second the blade splashed into the frigid waters. The captain and the journalist climbed along the net toward the bridge. The salt-crusted nylon dug into their fingers with every inch. "I have some bad news, Roberts." "Other than that we're hanging by a net in the dark over the North Pacific in January?" "Yes. The radio isn't working. We'll have to use theirs." The door to the cabin was intact, and the deck below it was a solid mass of splintered planks. When Roberts planted his boots on the beams, he took a sigh of relief and kept a tight grip on the fallen fishing equipment, just in case a wave might unsettle his balance. The captain handed off the glow rod and removed the crowbar from his backpack. The door pried loose with a single lurch and splintered like driftwood left by the tide. The dust settled as Elmore's eyes slowly adjusted to the black cabin. My God. Inside, the body of Captain Valeria of the RFS Bacchapur was hunched against the helm. The body was bitten with frost and white with the cold, and drops of brown blood dripped down over the cracked sonar. The pistol that hung from the captain's hands had fired its last bullet. Robert's camera panned over the room with a trembling hand. 7 shell casings rocked back and forth over the floor with each lap of the waves against the hull. Roberts could only guess where the other 6 bullets had gone. What in God's name happened here? Elmore carefully stepped past the body. It was frozen stiff, with the ICT radio receiver still gripped tightly in its left hand. The door to the crew cabin was open and swung idly with each rock of the boat. The glow rod cast dark shadows over the broken equipment. Roberts watched as Elmore pried the receiver free. He switched the controls over to the announcement system. If there was a living person left on the Bacchapur, they would hear him. "This is Captain Elmore of the Rusoil Primakov. We're here to assist. If you can hear me, please respond." The speakers crackled with static. As Elmore turned toward the camera, the hull below them shuddered. In that moment, both men froze in sudden attention. The low scream of steel echoed around them and mingled with their loud, white breaths. What was that?
Probably just the water in their hull.
I've heard ballast. That didn't sound like ballast.
Then I have no idea, okay?
The captain hailed the Primakov over the radio. The engineer responded with broken English and reported that the mercury was still dropping. He was afraid that the water in the hydraulics would freeze. Elmore told them to man the cranes and get them the hell back. While Elmore screamed against the static, Robert snapped his own glow rod and stepped through the door to the crew quarters. His camera swung from his shoulder as the staircase creaked under him. No one is quite sure what he saw down there. His camera's lens frosted over before he reached the bottom stair. It took 2 minutes for the crane from the Primakov to appear next to the little ship. Elmore saw it through the blackened plexiglass and waved his arms to signal his crew. The liquid in his glow rod was beginning to freeze and go dark. He shouted through the radio, "Get it closer to the bridge! Half the deck is missing, you stupid twit!" The end of the crane stopped only a few feet from the plexiglass and knocked gently against the mangled fishing equipment. The captain called out for Roberts, but there was no response. The spent bullet shells rocked back and forth across the floorboards in time with the door to the crew quarters. He swore to himself and told his crew to wait with the crane. Then he turned through the door. Roberts' camera was still recording when Elmore found it at the bottom of the stair. The lens had frosted over, but the microphone was still recording as the captain picked up the device and shook it. The metal in the hull creaked around him as he called out for Roberts. The ship was still partially flooded, and Elmore's boots splashed in the frigid ocean water.
"Roberts, get the hell out here! It's time to go!"
There was no response. The captain swore again and snapped another glow rod. The green light spread over the small cabin and illuminated the horrors within. The bodies of 6 Kamchatkan fishermen lay in their bunks with their flesh solid with ice and their eyes frozen open in sudden agonized terror. They had frozen in an instant. It was as if they had awoken from some nightmare and died of exposure before they could let out their final screams. The 7th body was crumpled at the foot of the stairs, riddled with bullet holes that had frozen shut faster than they had been made. Elmore was speechless. A sudden gasp burned like a blizzard in his lungs. Robert's frozen body lay in the shallow water, and as Elmore watched, the sea turned solid around it and crackled into a mass of ice. The air turned to snow around him, and the oxygen sublimed to rain. The hull screamed with a sudden, high-pitched fury. Elmore ran up the stairs and shouted into the radio, Start the engines! Get us the hell out of here!
The ship lurched under him. The crane to the Primakov dangled a few meters over the open ocean where the Bakopor's shattered deck used to be. The door to the crew's hold slammed shut as the freezing cold sucked in the air like a dark, gaping mouth. Elmore cursed himself as he kicked down the door. His only chance was to climb out over the precarious, tattered nets and then leap, somehow leap, onto the crane's lowest crossbeam. If he missed, his funeral would have an empty coffin. His boots clattered on the scrap of wood below him, and with a mighty heave, he pulled himself onto the tangled netting and twisted metal. With each step, the tattered nets froze and broke apart like icicles in his hands. With strength alone, he carried himself along the wrecked machinery over the open water, inching along as the metal frosted behind him. When he hung from the furthest point over the calm, black water, he reached with his hand toward the crane, but his fingers could only barely scrape the dangling nylon cords below it. He closed his eyes as white clouds puffed out from his nostrils. With a single, great shove, he launched himself through the air toward the crossbeam. His chest hit the metal, and he threw his arms around the steel cross. His breath was like lightning as he hung from the edge of the crane. The nylon ropes dangled near his vest while he hung on for dear life to the crossbeam. The tanker's great engines began to roar. The rotted fish turned to icicles behind him, and the hydraulics droned. Elmore collapsed on the deck of the Primakov, gasping in the frigid air. His breath was clear and cold because his spit had frozen around his tongue. The crane's engineer carried him like a fireman back to the warmth of the command center where the propellers were already churning. It took 2 hours before one of the engineers radioed the VMF about the status of the captain. In slow, phrasebook Russian, the engineer reported that Elmore was recovering from severe hypothermia and frostbite, but would retain command until delivery in Alaska. The VMF had scrambled salvage and cleanup for the Bakopor, but it would still be a few hours before they found the wreck, if they found it at all. The engineer didn't say what the captain had seen under the deck, but at midnight, the footage from Robert's camera synced up with the Gazette's website. As the Primakov sailed away at top speed, Elmore huddled beneath a space blanket as the crew's only medic, a nautical engineer from Seoul, tended to him with warm compresses and hot water. Elmore's breathing was labored and slow. The adrenaline had drained him, and now, even in the warm hull of the Primakov, it felt like ice was running through his veins. Alan, the midshipman, came up behind him with a hot cup of coffee. "Sir, when you've recovered, we've got a problem." "What is it, Alan?" "The hydraulics, sir. It looks like they've frozen over." Elmore's eyes drifted off over the frozen ocean.
There is nothing we want more than whatever is beyond the horizon. It can be anything. True love, a new car, a new job. Modern Warfare 2, I hear that's quite good. We, as a species, are never entirely happy with what we've got, and that's both our greatest weakness and our greatest strength. To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield, as Tennyson put it. That's what got us medicine, the written word, fire, and crucially, the concept of making bread products even more delicious by roasting them over that fire and then covering them with jam. But the problem with striving, seeking, finding, and not yielding is you don't actually stop. Ever. President Bartlett's iconic What's Next is not only a battle cry, but also a plea, a realization that things will never stop coming, and should they, by some miracle, ever stop, you'll miss them. We live in the saddle, and we die in the saddle, and if we don't, then all we do is wish we had. Or, to turn the words of one of the 20th century's greatest philosophers around just a little, you can't always get what you want, but that doesn't stop you from wanting it. Sometimes, though, it can make you appreciate what you have. Wherever you are this Christmas, whatever you're doing, take a moment to take a moment. Remember it. Nurture it. Plant a flag on a point of happiness, and when the shells start falling again, which they will, it's nothing personal, they just will. Go back to it. No storm lasts forever, and take it from someone who knows there's been pie before, there will be pie again. Or to put it another way, Happy Christmas from and to everyone at Escape Artists, everyone on our forum, especially the Mighty Odd Pod, our intrepid moderators, and MacArthur Bug. Pip pip, time for tea. Each and every one of you, all of you, are nothing short of extraordinary. So go stuff your faces and open your presents. You deserve it. Just don't call me calling during Doctor Who. Is it tawdry to ask for cash on Christmas Day? Absolutely, but I'm not recording this on Christmas Day, so it's fine. I have nothing but contempt for this court. You can't handle the truth. Anyway, if you liked this story and you're filled with festive cheer, please consider donating to help pay our authors and cover our costs. If you can't, please don't overextend yourself, but if you can, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you, we are so grateful for any help you can give. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod wishes you a very, very happy festive season. We'll see you in 2010. We'll be the people who look like us.